welcome to Jefferson Public Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are from Vermont, grew up on a rather spacious plot of land, from what I read, a large family farm.
Yeah. I grew up on a sheep farm.
A working sheep farm?
Yeah, absolutely. We had 65 ewes and 2 lucky rams, and every year about 120 little lambs.
Wow.
It wasn't my parents' source of income. It was deeper than a hobby, but definitely they had other jobs. But they were kind of hippie back to the landers in the early 70s, and they moved to Vermont. They bought the farm, and it was really important to them to be close to the land and be working on it, and the sheep were a way to do that.
And when you were young, I read that you did a lot of traveling.
Yeah, that was like a thing that my parents were into. They were into me doing it too. So we did some family traveling, and then also they would ship me off different places when I was young to get culture.
Did it work?
Oh, geez, I don't know. when I was in high school and college, I ended up I'd sort of got the bug from my parents early on. So I did some studying abroad when I was in school, and now I travel to play songs for people. So it sort of hasn't stopped.
And you weren't studying music, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, in college, I was a political science major, which I wouldn't do again. But at the time, it seemed like the right thing. And I studied languages, too.
So and I understand you had an idea of being a journalist.
I did. Yeah.
Like a public radio journalist or a newspaper journalist? Or?
You know, the journalists I admired most were the ones that wrote books, powerful books. There were a few books I read, like this guy, Philip Gourevitch. He's still a correspondent. I'm not sure who he works for, but he wrote this book about Rwanda that was like really powerful. And I don't know. So there's something about that lifestyle and the people that are really kind of on the front lines of that, in the thick of it, and, you know, telling those stories to people.
Was your desire to write books motivated by growing up with a father who wrote books, wrote novels?
Probably, you know. Yeah. My dad, he was also an English teacher. He just retired a couple years ago, but he taught English and film, and words were always really important in our house. And he was always, no one in my family plays music, but they're all big fans. And my dad especially is a big music fan and song fan, and he's a sort of a lyrics man. And he had a great record collection, and I remember my brother and my dad were really into, they would have committed entire albums to memory, you know, and so they'd put on like the Velvet Underground record, and then they'd like stand in the living room and they just shout every word of the record at each other. It was like a little ritual they did, and I'm sure that, you know, that turned me on to that style of art making.
Yeah. And now I read that some of the artists that you grew up listening to, and you've also mentioned as being some of your idols, musical idols, are songwriters that are known for their lyricism and for their storytelling. People like Leonard Cohen and Tom Waits and Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and Randy Newman even. And that comes through in your music as well. I was wondering if we could hear something to start off the session.
Sure, yeah. Well, I had a request, so I'm gonna try and do this song, which is from the new record that just came out, Young Man in America.
Thank you.
nothing gonna stop me now. Nothing gonna stop me now. Nothing gonna stop me now.
Music from the new album called Young Man in America. Anais, early on in your career, your music was discovered or heard by one of your musical idols, Ani DeFranco. And that relationship that started in that moment has kind of come back around a couple of times. Fast forward a couple of years, and you end up signing for her record label, Righteous Babe Records. And another couple of years go by, and she turns up singing one of the parts on an album that was in gestation, I gather, for many years for you. This album that came out a couple of years back called Hadestown. Tell me about how you first met Ani and how that relationship started to formulate and grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I did kind of come of musical age with Ani's music. And when I first started playing the guitar, I think I learned a few folk songs, you know, three chord folk songs from the Rise Up Singing book. And then I just started learning Ani DeFranco songs. And so, you know, her influence is really inseparable from that early, the early songs I wrote. Like, it's, I don't know if I'd have picked up the guitar if it weren't for her music. So certainly, you know, she looms pretty large in my constellation of musical heroes. And I met her when I was about, I think I was probably 23, and I had put out a record called Hymns for the Exiled. And somehow it had gotten to the ears of this promoter in Buffalo, who was a really wonderful guy. He passed away a couple of years ago, sadly, but his name was Michael Meldrum. And he was sort of a, I don't know, godfather of musical happenings in the town of Buffalo. And he would bring young artists to town and put on shows for them. And he also was Ani DeFranco's childhood guitar teacher. And so they maintained a relationship throughout her career. And so he had me doing some shows, and I guess she was in town off tour, and he invited her out to them. And she showed up with her some of her crew from Righteous Babe. And
did you know she was there?
Yeah, right. I know. I didn't know she was there in the first set. I think I realized it in the set break.
So that first set went a lot better than the second, then, right?
Yeah, I was like, oh man, I got it. Yeah, it was really amazing. It was really something. And then that she reached out and wanted to put out my records was, you know, just huge. And it was really great to get to go on tour with her and just be sort of let into that world of the Righteous Babe family. Is there's so many awesome artists that are associated with it in one way or another. And Hamill on Trial and Aaron McKeown and the people that do the graphics, Brian Grunert for them. And it's a really cool group of people. And so yeah. And then a few years later, I was working on Hadestown, and she agreed to sing that role, the Persephone part, before I think she'd even heard the music, which was a big leap of faith on her part. And it was so great because having her on board sort of emboldened me to be like, I wonder who else, you know, might sing on this record. And
right.
She reached out to Greg Brown. They have a long-standing friendship, and he was always my first choice for the King of the Underworld. And so she dropped him a line, and he said he would do it. And it's great. You know, I actually, this new record, I put it out on my own label, which is sort of, in a sense, following in her footsteps.
Of what Ani used to do.
Blazed that trail a long time ago.
Let's talk about Hadestown for a minute. The gestation for this was many years in the past. And in fact, one of the songs that was, I guess, an early version of what became Hadestown showed up on the album that you put out called The Brightness. The people who have written long-form operas, and yours is referred to as a folk opera, but Monteverdi, Gluck, Offenbach, Anais Mitchell have all written operas on this theme. How does this get started in your head?
Yeah. Well, I think that one reason that it's such a popular myth to musicalize is because the hero is this great musician, you know, Orpheus. It's sort of a narcissistic thing probably for songwriters and composers to want to tell his story because he's their sort of icon. But for me, it really, there wasn't a grand plan. You know, I wrote a couple of songs, including that one that ended up on The Brightness early on, and they just sort of came out of nowhere, the way sometimes a song will come out of nowhere, and they seem to be on this theme. And I got excited, to tell a story over a cycle of songs, because storytelling has always been really important to me, and I love balladry and the old British ballads, and I think a lot of my songs end up being little tiny stories with a narrator, and so this was sort of a chance to really just go all the way with that and stretch out. And I had noticed that I would go to a songwriter show, even someone that I really admired and loved, and I love songs, it's my favorite thing in the world, but after about like 45 minutes I'd start looking at my watch, you know, whereas I'd watch a terrible movie all the way to the end because there's this contract with you know, the watcher, the one who experiences a story. There's a contract with the storyteller that, you know, if you stick this out, if you get to the end, there's going to be some reward. You'll be delivered somewhere different than where you started. And I think that really appealed to me, to be able to tell a grand story.
At what point did you realize that you were committed to this becoming a, what is it, 40-minute?
Yeah, it's
40
an hour,
piece?
Actually, in
as it's done live?
Yeah. You know what happened is I applied for a grant in Vermont, where I'm from, and it was a small grant. It was actually not even that much money, but it was this organization that helps out, you know, artists, but also schools and arts organizations. And I applied for a grant to produce this opera with these different collaborators. Michael Chorney, I was going to ask Michael Chorney to write the score, and then my friend Ben Matchstick to direct the show. And I got the grant, which was like, I couldn't believe it. And then it was like, all right, I got to do it.
Was your intention for it to be a fairly static music-based opera, or with actual staging and costuming and
yeah, that was always the goal.
Wow.
To have the staging, and my friend Ben is such a visual guy, very far out kind of bread and puppet style puppeteer, street theater kind of guy, and that always appealed to me to work with him and create this visual spectacle.
So why did it take so long for the recording? Was it a matter of you getting to a position in your career and in your trajectory where you had the resources to do it, or did it take that long for you to really wrap your head around what you wanted to create for a recording?
Yeah, it was a lot of things. It was another draft. You know, I definitely changed a lot of stuff for the recording, and that took some time. And then there was working with Todd. So we already had our score that Michael had written, which had six instruments. We ended up working with Todd Sikafoos, who's Ani DeFranco's bass player, and he had sort of his own imagination for how this thing could be translated as an audio document without the visual stuff. And then there was the matter of getting the singers on there, and you know, people imagine that it was all of us in a room like We Are the World style with our headphones on, but actually it was more like a scavenger hunt. Like I went to different towns. I went to Iowa City to work with Greg. I went to New Orleans to work with Ani, Eau Claire to work with Justin. It was a sort of a treasure hunt. And then getting the files and bringing them back to Brooklyn, where Todd was, and then going through them and putting everyone on the same record.
Well, the song that leads off that album is one that you sing with Justin Vernon,
yeah,
called Wedding Song. Could you do that one for us?
Absolutely, yeah. Tell me if you can, who's gonna buy the wedding bands? Times being what they are, hard and getting harder all the time. Lover, when I sing my song, all the rivers sing along, and they're gonna break their banks for me, lay their gold around my feet. All the flashing in the pan, all the fashion for your hand. The river gonna give us the wedding bands. Lover, tell me if you're able, who's gonna lay the wedding table? Times being what they are, dark and getting darker all the time. Lover, when I sing my song, all the trees gonna sing along and bend their branches down to me. Lay gold around my feet, the almond and the apple, and the sugar from the maple, and the trees gonna lay the wedding table.
Wedding Song, it's Anais Mitchell live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Your new album is called Young Man in America, and there are a lot of songs on the album that seem to be sung from the viewpoint of one main protagonist. Did you have the intention of it almost being a narrative of a sole character?
No, I didn't have an intention like that. In a weird way, I think the most honest answer is that by dressing up in the clothes of a man, I felt freer to write stuff that felt really true for me, but not be suspected of writing in an autobiographic way, you know? There's also the fact that my dad is a really important figure on this record. It's his face on the cover.
You know, prior to Hadestown, the sound of your albums tended to be sparse, relatively quiet, you and a guitar in many cases. With Hadestown, there's this large force of musicians and singers. And with the new album, it seems that progression is continued. There's a lot more production to the album. There's a chorus on a couple of songs, more instrumentation. Was that a natural progression that you wanted to take, or was that the combined discussion and influence of you and Todd, who produced the album?
Yeah, I'd say both of those things, you know. Of course, Todd produced Hadestown, and then he produced this one too. And I think there's a way in which, and there's also a way in which because Young Man has a lot of stories on it, and there is this chorus, and I always wanted that, a chorus of voices that would be kind of this like little tribe to take part in the kind of ritual aspect of some of the songs and act as a character in its own right.
You mentioned that the album was inspired by a novel that your father wrote, and specifically I read that The Shepherd was inspired by that. I was wondering if you might do that for us.
Sure, I will, yeah. And it's a direct inspiration. Said the shepherd to his wife, "Crop of hay is cut and dry. I'll bale it up and bring it in before the coming storm begins. Go," she said, "and beat the storm, and then there is another chore. Today the baby will be born. You'll take me to the hospital." Said the shepherd, "If it's true, 'twere better if I stayed with you. I'd rather let the harvest go and hasten to the hospital. Nay," she told him, "I'll be fine. We both have laboring to do. You do yours and I'll do mine. Through." Ooh. The shepherd rode the yellow rose, the clouds above and the field below, until the bales had all been tied. Then homeward turned to find his wife. The sweat was wet upon her brow, her breath it cameth laboredly, and then the rain was coming down upon the field, the yellow hay. Said the shepherd, it's no use, the rain will surely win the race, 'twere better if we let it fall and hurry to the hospital. Go, she said, and work with haste, and bring the bales into the barn, else the crop will go to waste, and the babe will wait till the work is done. Barn till half the bales were safely in, then went to find his wife again. How many times her name he called, and no replying would she make. Her breath it came and none at all, and she would not rise from where she lay. Saw the sun come out, the shepherd's wife saw near again. He buried her and the babe within. He turned the seed into the ground. He brought the flock to feed thereon. He held the cleaver and the plow, and the shepherd's work was never done.
Shepherd is from the new album called Young Man in America. That is one of those tunes that kind of causes you to lose time when you're listening to it. It's a beautiful song.
Oh, thanks.
I remember reading in an interview that you did prior to Young Man being released, where you were talking about this upcoming project, where your focus was to put together a record of old British ballads. And yet this album comes out and they're all your songs. So were you talking about songs of yours that were inspired by old British ballads, or do you actually have another project that you're working on?
No, yeah, there's another project. They were kind of neck and neck for a while, you know, the two of them, and then this one pulled ahead to the finish line, and so now we're sort of spending some time, you know, running around with this record. But the other one is, it's a collaboration with my friend Jefferson Hamer, who sings some harmonies on this record, and it's these old British and Scottish folk ballads, you know, the Child Ballad Collection. They're not children's songs, but they were collected at the turn of the century by this guy, Francis James Child. And they're these amazing, epic songs. They're all like 7 minutes long. And they're, some of them are like fairy tales. There's supernatural goings on, witches and, elves and things like that.
No real time frame for that yet?
Like maybe early next year. That's my, cool. I would reckon.
Yeah. It's Anais Mitchell live on Open Air on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Anais, so nice to meet you. Thanks for taking time to visit us.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric.